Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Look Ahead podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today is my good friend, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, with a look at the week ahead and whatever else is on his mind. Byron, hope you had a great weekend had a very good St. Patrick's Day.
Well, we did, Vago. You know, spring has arrived.
It's lovely. I'm out here in California. I spent the weekend aboard the Queen Mary. And for anybody who's a history buff, I strongly encourage that because it's an incredible ship. Just what an experience and what a wartime role it played. I don't know if many people in the audience know, but the highest number of people ever on a ship was aboard Queen Mary in World War II, moving troops. And I think it was almost 17,000 people. And before we get started, a word from today's sponsor. HII is a trusted defense and technologies partner, supporting all services in all domains and the only builder of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. HII delivering the advantage. Byron, it's been a week since the Biden administration submitted its FY 2025 $849.8 billion budget request, Pentagon budget request. You joined us last week, obviously, before really you had a chance to dig into the entire budget. It's been a week. On Friday's show, the take was almost universally negative. As you know, not enough money and questionable decisions that, according to some on our panel, were sending the wrong signals to both friend and foe. I'm not as negative on this budget, and I'm on the record on that. But as the week went on, where are you from sort of a macro perspective before we dive deeper into each of the services which you've been dissecting?
Well, let's start. I think, you know, first couple of observations, Vago. Not all the budget is out yet. I mean, as we speak, for example, a Navy budget justification books for research, development, test, and evaluation haven't been posted on their website yet. So this becomes kind of a rolling set of analyses that, you know, you have to kind of stitch everything together. And the, you know, budget justification books are a very important part in building that broader view. And then I think, you know, I just want to reiterate, it's a difficult budget to assess because of the uncertainty around the FY24 appropriations and the Security Supplemental Act. And I mean, in this budget, you know, this is going to go a little wonky here, but, you know, the administration included kind of placeholders for both those items in their budget authority figures, and then those flow through to outlays. So you really don't know what the outcome of those, either of those, is going to be yet. So it's still a budget that I think is going to take a bit more dissecting, a little bit more analysis too. But, you know, stepping back, look, you guys talked about it a little bit on the Monday show. I'm not as bent out of shape about the macroeconomic kind of the fiscal outlook, at least in the context of this budget compared to prior budgets. I mean, I always think you have to look at both the OMB and CBO forecasts, and they're really projections, they're not forecasts per se. You know, each has its own issues and shortfalls. I could point out that within the OMB forecast, you know, they've made certain assumptions about what's going to happen with the supplemental, as I just mentioned, but also, you know, what portion of the 2017 tax cuts could expire in 2025. You know, what's going to be remaining going forward, and what are they going to allow expire? And then there are other little things like, you know, you look at the Department of Transportation budget for outlays. There's a sharp fall off in infrastructure spending in 2026. You know, does that really get realized? The one thing that I thought was intriguing, you know, it screams out when you look at this, is just how important mandatory spending is and in driving this budget. And, you know, the focus on the Congress, particularly in the House, has been on cutting discretionary spending. You know, that's not what you need to get under control here. You know, if you really want to get your arms around this thing, both non-defense and defense discretionary spending are really at record lows if you look at percent of GDP back to 1962. The one change that I thought that was interesting, that I didn't see a lot of people call out, was the administration basically baked in higher interest rates into its interest outlay forecast. So it wasn't as if the deficit had changed so much. it was that the money that they expect to pay on interest is higher. And I think that's just a very prudent and logical reflection of what's been happening in treasury markets. Yeah, go ahead,
Let me
Vago.
just dive briefly into this, right? Because you discussed what is really the third rail, right? This is the first year where payments on the debt are higher than the defense budget itself, right? I mean, so we have crossed the Rubicon that many have discussed for a long time, that this was an iceberg with which we were going to collide, to put it in, I mean, a maritime mood, Byron. And ultimately, this is both about entitlements reform. It's also about cutting spending, and it's also about letting tax cuts not only expire, but actually increasing taxes ultimately. But it's an election year. What do the mechanics of this look like, and what is it that investors and what or strategic planners need to be considering about what this outlook looks like? Because at some point, given where interest rates are, borrowing more money is not an attractive thing to do, right?
No, but I mean, that's what we're going to do. I mean, I just think, there's not a consensus on how much the US can afford to borrow. And the only people that who I've seen have done at least taken an intellectually honest approach to this was University of Pennsylvania Wharton. Their budget model team basically said, you could get this up to 200% of GDP, that being US debt held by the public. Which is currently around 100%. But the variability is really around interest rates. And to their point, it's about a 20-year time frame before, I mean, we really hit the wall on this. And that's when you start having, a profound economic impact. You have to talk about things like a national value-added tax. I mean, the capital markets won't stand for that at a point, that debt level, the ability to service that debt. So we still have room to move in the event of another pandemic, a major conflict, but that's I think the problem with a lot of these projections, Vago, both OMB and CBO projections just kind of assume the world is still steady state. There's not another recession, there's not another pandemic, there's not a major conflict. And if you look back at the history of US debt and deficit spending, it's the recessions, the wars, and the pandemics that have usually caused the spike in that. And we haven't been paying that with that for taxes. We have not been paying with taxes for those increases. So the debt has increased. And until capital markets are a forcing function on this, maybe they already are. Interest rates have risen. The 10-year is, above 4%. Some people believe that's just a reflection that inflation is going to be higher. Others believe that it's really a message that markets are sending to Washington, D.C., that you've got to start getting your fiscal house in order. But as I said, I don't think you're going to solve that with discretionary spending. You got to either address, you have to address both mandatory spending and taxes to really start to pull this thing in a different direction.
You did take a look at and focus a little bit on what the services were doing, even though, right, I mean, as you said, the Navy J books are not out. What were some of the things that, after you had a chance to really dig into the budget, you saw what you liked, what you maybe didn't like as much?
Well, look, this really was the first year in a long time where I think DoD had to make hard choices, and they took it in some of their platform programs. And to Deputy Secretary of Defense Hicks's comments on the budget rollout a week ago from Monday, she said we really need that out year growth if we're going to deliver on a strategy that was set forth in 2022. I don't know if they're going to get that, Vago, and that's really going to be the tension that I think you're going to continue to see in defense budgets is, can the DoD continue to afford these very large, exquisite weapon systems? And is that going to create more room for things like the collaborative combat aircraft or unmanned naval systems, and kind of sweeping across all these services is just going to be the talent battle that the department is going to face to find people to serve. So, as long as the economy is humming along and unemployment is at very low rates, they're still going to be facing a recruitment and, frankly, a retention challenge if they don't keep pace with civilian pay. Look, I mean, I don't think this, you know, the polemics around, oh, you know, this wasn't enough money, all this other stuff. I mean, come on, you know, the Congress passed the Fiscal Responsibility Act. You can't turn around, vote for that, and then say that defense didn't get enough money. I mean, if you voted for that bill, you know, you're complicit in the top line that the DoD had to build that budget to. So stop complaining and figure out other ways to address the fiscal outlook that, you know, we can all see for the United States, and what will that mean for where defense spending will, not this year, but over the next couple of years, and how will that contribute to national security? You know, I'll say this again, Vago. You know, I really hate the distinction between defense and non-defense as kind of a, you know, a dividing line between what contributes to national security and what doesn't. I mean, the CHIPS Act is funded out of non-defense discretionary spending. And I think a lot of people would contend that, you know, having a sound and robust microelectronics semiconductor industry in the United States is really critically important to our national security. So cutting non-defense discretionary spending really could erode national security very significantly.
Last week on the Washington Roundtable, we did discuss the submarine cut in particular. Dove took exception to it. The Navy decided that instead of ordering two nuclear-powered attack submarines, it would order one. I believe we were the first to discuss that. You know, we had heard that there was going to be only one submarine in the budget, and we're big fans of submarines. I'm a big fan of submarines. I don't think you can have enough of them, and we're paying an unfortunate price for decisions that we took 20 years ago, ultimately. But Mike McCord made the case, as did Undersecretary Raven, that 12 were already on order, and they're all backed up and they're not delivering on time. And so why don't we invest in the submarine industrial base capacity that will allow us to get to those two attack boats a year for the United States, as well as then service the Australians. And one of Dove's concerns was that you know, the message that we're sending, not just the Chinese, given that they're concerned about our undersea capability, you know, that our undersea capability worries them, but also the signal that we're sending to Australia. You know, and Patrick Cronin wasn't altogether that crazy about that either. From your standpoint, is this sending the wrong signal to our allies and partner, to our adversaries as well as our allies?
On the
Any change
contrary,
in your
yeah, on the
assessment?
contrary. I mean, I think anybody who listened to the briefings, you know, both the Navy briefing and Mike McCord's comments, I mean, he was pretty clear. You know, you've got to get the industrial base going to achieve, you know, a 2.3 build rate for Virginia class. I mean, you could put all the money you want in the budget, and sure, there's symbolism to that, but the Chinese can see what's going on in our shipyards too. So what? You buy two submarines or fund two submarines this year, the money sits in appropriations accounts and the submarines don't get built in time. I mean, if anything, I thought on the contrary, you know, building out the industrial base and allowing that capacity to deliver, you know, potentially the AUKUS requirements too in the 2030s, that's a more powerful message than just the simple, you know, kind of route symbolism of, oh, here's more money for a submarine that you're not going to deliver on time. You know, and Vago, I mean, the time horizons on these things are, you know, the FY24 submarine, it starts construction in March 2030 and it delivers in March 2038. So it's like you're talking about delivery cycles that are just 100% agree with you. You know, submarines are still one of the primary asymmetric advantage that the U.S. has over all militaries globally. I'm not trying to say don't do this. Don't eventually get back to the 2 a year cadence, maybe even more. But I think the notion of symbolism is a little worn here. That I think, you know, what China's probably going to pay more attention to is what was said about readiness and, you know, being able to fight tomorrow's wars today, you know, and having a force that really can continue to sustain and deploy in the Indo-Pacific in the 2020s and not just in the 2030s and beyond.
Do you have any other budgetary things that you want to touch on and things you
Well,
covered
no,
in your
Vado,
Monday note?
I think the, you know, the other, there were other elements of the slip in the industrial base. I thought the, you know, these had been reported or appreciated, but you know, the 1 year slip in the Constellation class frigate at Fincantieri. I thought the other linkage that was pretty interesting was just how important the security supplemental is to ramping up the munitions industrial base. And, you know, DOD, I think, pounded that drum as loud as they could. Whether Congress listens is another story.
Let me take you to the question of Boeing. It is something we talk about a lot, and unfortunately, the company is... you know, as Ron said on Sunday's show, you know, it takes a century to build a reputation. It doesn't take long to jeopardize it. And now, whether it's the traveling public is being critical and worrying that they're flying on Boeing planes, you have airlines that are their customer, you know, as Alaska Airlines did, post a warning that says, look, I mean, our growth plans depend on getting these MAX 7 and 9 jets, and we don't know when we're going to be getting them, you know, and then the groundings that took airplanes offline in order to inspect. And you know, the KC-46 tanker program has been a bleeder for a long time. There are further delays on that program. The T-7 trainer is also delayed, you know, and for some, the company is approaching a coffin corner, given that, you know, the commercial side of the business underwrites the defense side of the business, you know, in a budget downturn, and then the commercial side, or rather the defense side, then helps, you know, the company weather a commercial downturn. From your standpoint, sort of where are we? What are the aggregate impacts? What's the worry point? And as I asked the entire team yesterday, what's the way out of this, and what's a reasonable time horizon to get out of this?
I think, Vago, you know, maybe the media focus right now on, you know, Boeing is a disaster is a little bit of, you know, kind of let's pile on the rabbit. It's, you know, when a plane goes off a runway, kind of who cares? But the headline is now Boeing airplane goes off runway. And right. So you get into this cycle of, I think the news cycle has gotten ahead of actually, you know, where things may stand at Boeing. I don't cover the commercial aerospace side closely. I really have to leave that to, you know, other analysts, including
right.
Ron and Sash on your show, and Richard, obviously. But, you know, on the defense side, you know, maybe on the defense side, the KC-46 had really been the canary in the coal mine that things were just not right at that company, you know, and this goes back years. So maybe the news cycle has kind of gotten caught up to some real foundational problems in the company. You know, at the end of the day, this is going to be management leadership. It's going to be the board of directors too. But, you know, and it's also going to be a battle that's going to have to be fought, you know, really kind of on the front line with employees. At a time in my career where I did cover Boeing, you know, they had driven the wheels off things like commercial airplane production at one point in their, in a time when I covered the company. You know, they eventually got a turnaround. I remember they had a New York investor meeting, and they were talking all about lean. You know, I went out to visit the guy who was supposedly, you know, in charge of lean and Boeing. He was in a little cubicle in one of their offices in Renton, Washington. So, you know, but went back 2 or 3 years later, and it's like, oh yeah, they were starting to really incorporate this into how their factory floors were being laid out. So I'm not as close to it as some of the other people on your show. You know, but my hunch is maybe the news cycle is a little bit ahead of and more negative than where things actually are with the company. How they get it turned around, I think is, you know, it's going to be leadership. It's going to be a lot of hard, nasty, long weekends and nights. And, you know, it's the old just getting back down to basics. And then hopefully they're in a position where they can start investing again in their business and not just, you know, putting out each fire as it pops up here.
Our mutual friend, Cliff Ransom of Ransom Research, would Fire a CEO for that, right? I mean, if your lean guy is just in a shack somewhere and not thoroughly integrated across the entire company, I can hear him, talking to us about that now. That one's for you, Cliff. Byron, I want to take you to Leonardo DRS's Investor Day. Folks, full disclosure, of course, Leonardo DRS is one of our sponsors, and everybody looks to CEO Bill Lynn's take on the budget, where we are industrially and otherwise. He's going to be joining us soon. He's former Deputy Defense Secretary and one of the most highly respected people in American defense, whether he was in industry or whether he's in government. Walk us through what the key takeaways were from your standpoint.
Well, I think first, this is the season. There have been a bunch of these meetings in New York. I'll talk about one in a minute, Vago, that HAI is going to hold this week. But look, I think the central message was, they're a unique kind of mid-tier defense company that's focused on technology areas that they think are really aligned with key defense priorities, and that they've got the agility and they've really kind of thought through where they're going to be. It's a somewhat difficult company to analyze because they are so diverse. So, Columbia class, the content they have on that program is about 10% of their sales. And then it really starts to fall off pretty quickly. But I think this broader issue about naval ship electrification, force protection, computer processing, these are all trends that I think should fare them fairly well. In going back to the budget environment we talked about, where these hard choices are going to be made, if they're not on the new program, Columbia, I think, is sacrosanct in this kind of environment. But let's say we don't, move ahead with the XM-30, there'll probably be more upgrades on, combat armored vehicles like the Bradley. So, there are other companies that can make that same claim. But I always appreciate, and I really think people should generally appreciate, the amount of time that probably goes into preparing for these meetings, the fact that you get an entire management team there and you get to see more than just the CEO, chairman, and CFO. Frankly, the most valuable thing out of some of these meetings is seeing some of the senior line managers, division heads. And I hope they get as much out of these meetings as I believe analysts and investors do.
And speaking of analysts and investors, HII is going to have their meeting next week. What are your expectations?
Well, again, I think, probably fairly stable shipbuilding environment. They're going to have to, walk through the impact of things like the Virginia class slip and, carrier funding got pushed out a little bit. I think the really interesting part in this company is going to be the mission technologies area that, people at Huntington Ingalls, the word associating game is naval ships, and submarines, but that mission technologies area is really building out quite nicely. And it'll be interesting to see kind of how HAI explains, what they're doing with that business and how that's also informing their views of future naval needs and the needs of other defense customers.
Is it, going back to a little bit of the messaging challenge, right? I mean, the DRS folks feel like, look, we're, do so much stuff, like, for example, on electrical systems on ships, but also the microelectronics on vehicles, right? I mean, as you said, running the entire gamut in that mezzanine, right? To use Frank Lanza's, the late great Frank Lanza's lingo. From an HII standpoint, do folks fully appreciate that the company is, at this point, a company that is really transforming to something very different that actually will be able to leverage some of these technologies to improve shipbuilding, right? I mean, the strategy that Mike Petter has put out and that Chris Kastner has been articulating is our growth in all of these other areas, whether in AI and machine learning, and everything else, makes the shipbuilding part of the business and the unmanned part of the business or uninhabited part of the business better. What's the challenge in sort of expressing that to the market? And is that something you think that the folks that you talk to and investors sort of are better understanding, as opposed to getting fixated on the shipbuilding side of things?
Look, personally, I think sometimes analysts, they just get too wrapped around, what's the near-term guidance? And, the irony was, DRS Leonardo's stock, I think, fell 4% the day after their investor meeting. I don't know what people were expecting on it, but I mean, the guidance that they gave for, I think, 4 to 7% organic growth was just fine. I think what people should have really taken away with was we're building for the long term, and this isn't some kind of flash in the pan. We're buying back all our stock, and that's how we're going to run our business. On the contrary, and I think the same is going to be true with HAI. It may be difficult. The analysts are still going to focus on, so how's guidance, where margins going to be? What are you going to do with cash flow? How much cash are you going to return to shareholders? It's a hard thing to articulate, Vago, because people are going to look at, well, how is that going to fit into my model? Where's my line item that lines up with the things you're doing at HAI with what I can pull from the budget justification books and go, aha, there's where their growth is going to be over the next 5 years, and this is how they're going to grow faster or better than some of their peers. So that's always tough, but companies have to take their best crack at it, and maybe the analysts don't always get it, but hopefully some of their investors do.
And Byron, before we go, what should the audience be paying attention to this week, given that you've got the best look ahead list in the business?
We're back into House and Senate hearings. Not the big ones that relate to the FY25 budget, but HASC is doing a March 20th hearing on military posture in Indo-Pacific and another on strategic forces posture. Senate Armed Services is holding a hearing on the 20th on the findings of the PPBE Commission. House Foreign Affairs is doing one on military-related technology exports and how that impacts contractors. AUSA is doing a budget event with the U.S. Army, kind of on the March 18th on today, basically, on the rollout. There are some other think tank events. Reagan Institute is doing their National Security Innovation Base Summit. Atlantic Council is doing an interesting event, I think, on what the future of Republican foreign policy is going to be. There is a presentation by General Richardson, Commander U.S. Southern Command. She speaks at the Atlantic Council on March 19th.
Byron, thanks very much as always. Hope you have a great day, great week. Look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Fago.
The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Thanks very much again for listening today. We'll be back again tomorrow for our weekly strategy report. And joining us will be Dr. Eugene Rumer of the Carnegie Endowment and our good friend Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analyses. They're going to be joining us to discuss what Vladimir Putin has in store for his latest term in office, the opposition movement to his rule, the Ukraine war, as well as Kyiv's ability to strike deep in Russia. Please tune in. It's going to be a terrific conversation. Thanks very much for joining us. And until we see you again tomorrow, have a great day.